Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to this special best of episode of Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And I kind of figured with the holidays all around us, I'd just pick some of my favorite segments from this past year and play them today and next week. I hope you enjoy them. Well, good morning, everybody. Happy weekend. How are y'all doing? I mean, we hit the weekend, so really there can't be that much complaining out there, right? I mean, we hit the best part of the whole week. And I'm wondering, what has everybody got going on today, you know, after the show? I'm sure you're not going to bail on the show. Or maybe you're going to work while the show's going, but what do you got going? Maybe a home project, maybe a little painting. Maybe you're just going to crash, you know, watch a few movies. That sounds kind of good. Personally, I've kind of got a hankering to go roller skating. Don't really know why. We watched Back to the Future over the Christmas break. I'm wondering if that's it. You know, maybe the 80s nostalgia kind of hit a little hard and brought me, you know, back to my big time memories. You know, skating around the Grand Roller Rink in Holland, if any of you remember that place. Doing that when I was in elementary school. You know, I had some big times, some big memories back then. You know, a cooler kid you've never seen. You know, skating smoothly in this huge loop around this place, the disco ball and all the music going on, you know, only falling periodically, you know, that was pretty good. Skating with a girl even a couple of times, I remember that, you know, getting a little sweaty, you know, my little sweaty hand while I was doing that. And then finding it really hard to keep a hold of her over, you know, the turns because of the sweaty hand. Sometimes, whoop, she just kind of zip off to the side and crash into the wall. And I'd go back to skating alone. Anyway, rambling, roller skating, the golden years, when I was in elementary school. Anyway, I don't know how I got to roller skating, but it's a thought. It's something that you might want to consider, right? Think about it. All right, who cares? Let's get back to the show. Today, we're going to be talking about New Year's resolutions. Now, last week, Friday, I think it was Quitter's Day, the day most people give up on their New Year's resolutions. There's actually a day devoted to it, Quitter's Day. Yeah, that was last week, Friday. And so we're going to talk now about a mind trick, like a little Jedi mind trick to help you stick to your resolutions longer and actually see them to completion. So we're going to get to that at the end of the show. We're also going to talk briefly about primers. I mean, really, in a world full of paint and primer all-in-one products, why do primers even exist in the first place? You know, why would you want one or why would you use one? Is it just, you know, wasted steps, you know, money, extra money spent? Or is it a secret weapon to help you achieve professional results and actually save money? Who knows? Who knows? Only the shadow knows. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But right now, I've got a paint point that I want to get to, and it's going to take me a long time to do it because I found a really fun article that sets it up. And this fun article was supposed to be just this brief introduction to the topic that I wanted to cover, the paint point itself. But this little article is so good, it warrants its own segment. It's not a brief introduction, it's its own segment. So we're going to talk about that. I'm short, right? I don't hide that. I don't think I'm ridiculously short. I like to say average height, you know, when I'm having conversations with friends and family. But when I do say that, people around me always look at me and say, you know, you're on the shorter side of average, just so you know. You know, people like to keep me honest, I guess. Let's just say I'm not tall, all right? Let's just establish that. But could I be? That is the bigger question. Is it possible, you know, to make a few, you know, outer changes, something simple, and gain some height? And I'm not talking silly changes like walk around in stilts. I mean legitimate changes that will give height to somebody of average or, you know, on the shorter side of average height. Well, I did a lot of research into this topic, and I found an article online that seems really super legit. And I discovered that, yes, with a few simple changes and a little exercise, but really, some simple changes, I can go, listen to this, from 5'7"-ish all the way up to 6'3" in about 6 months. In fact, I could go from 5'7" to 6'1" in hours. That extra 2 inches, you know, to get to 6'3", that comes from exercise. That's going to take time. I'm trying to decide if it's worth it do I really need those extra 2 inches, or shall I just go with this, you know, the plan that will have me at 6'1" in hours? Anyway, here are my findings. Here are my findings, and here's my plan. And for all of you other height challenge folks, you know, get out the notepads. I'm dishing out gold here. All right, tips to consider to if you want to look taller, the tips that you'll need. We're going to start simple. First off, wear shoes that make you look taller. You know, this isn't rocket science. I just need to find some shoes that have a bit of a sole, you know, a lot of sole. And I need to find it, you know, shoes that have a sole composed of lightweight material, I guess. You know, it can't be thick, heavy rubber, or I'm going to get tired, you know, really quick. I don't want that. So I'm going to look for tall shoes that are lightweight. And when I find them, I'm easily, according to this article, going to be able to add at least half an inch. So there we go. I am right now at 5'7.5". We're going to do the math and keep track. Okay. 5'7.5" just from shoes alone. I could go higher, but I don't want to be ridiculous. All right. Second thing, lose body fat. All right. This one's the exercise thing. I'll decide if I want to do it. But it turns out weight actually compresses the spine. I guess that's not rocket science either. Really, it does make a lot of sense. You know, if I wore a necklace of 25-pound weight plates, I'd compress my spine. I'm pretty sure of it. I'm not a doctor. It just seems to flow. It makes sense. So the same is probably true when it comes to a little extra girth. Probably weighs me down a little bit, compresses my spine. I bet my body blubber, you know, is probably holding me back, you know, maybe from another inch. So if I lose that weight, my spine's going to decompress and boop, I'm going to shoot up probably another inch, maybe more. So it's not easy to lose weight. I get that, but it's not impossible. So I'm planning on it. And if I do that and pull it off, that'll make me 5'8.5". Okay. Third thing, improve your posture. Again, no rocket science here. Still not at that point yet. That's coming. But slouching makes you look shorter. So the guy who wrote the article, he went into the military, and after 26 weeks of training, he had grown another inch and a half. Another inch and a half after just 26 weeks of boot camp and training. You know, he attributes it to good posture. So slouching, it's the short man's enemy. So I'm going to work on eliminating the slouch. And let's just say that by doing so, I'm going to gain, you know, another inch. So, you know, 5'9.5". All right? Okay. Now, number four, wear fitted clothing. And I really don't know how I feel about this one. And I don't know that it's really all about being tall. It's about creating the illusion of being tall. One of his paragraphs, actually, when I look at this point, I only included it because of this paragraph that he has in there. It's kind of cutting. It hurts a little bit. Let me quote it. You wear well-fitting clothing because, quote, those things won't make you look taller per se, but because we associate good things in clusters and being tall is good, this is in his quote, dressing well goes a long way in creating the illusion of height, or at the very least, it draws attention away from how short you are, end quote. Wow. I don't know. I'm not sure what to do with that. I don't know. Wear fitted clothing. I'll let you decide if you're going to pursue that one. I just wanted to give his quotes because I thought he's pulling no punches here. He's trying to help us and he's being brutal in the process. All right. And it's funny, I should say, the guy's 6 foot something. So it's not like he's one of us talking to us. He's talking down to us in every way that you can talk down to people. You know, he's 6 foot three or something like that. I don't know how tall he is after boot camp. Gained another 3 inches. Could be 7 foot tall by now. Who knows? He's talking down to us short people. Anyway, number five. Let's get back to his recommendations. Wear a hat. Now here we're hitting some dark horse, unexpected gold star recommendations. Hats make you look taller, of course, because they extend the top of your head. And, you know, as an aside, you know, a freebie, if you will, tall hair, I could do the same thing. You know, few people realize it, but I think Lyle Lovett, you know, that singer, I think he's actually 5'2". But with the hair, you know, he clocks in over 6 foot. Now, I can't get my hair to do that, but I can plop a hat on my head. Now, Panama hat, that would give me a good inch or so. I think it could. It'd make me look like Indiana Jones, so that's cool. But a top hat, here's where I'm going. A top hat, that seems to be the way to go. You know, first, you gain another 6 inches or more, depending on your top hat. Secondly, it's super classy, right? And classy clothes, you know, also distract from how short you are. We just talked about that. Wear fitted clothes. I'm reading that as classy clothes. So top hat, that's classy. It'll distract from how short I am. So if I take that top hat, you know, I'm going to add 4 more inches, you know, maybe 6 more inches if I went nuts, but let's just be reasonable. 4 more inches. I was at 5'9" something. I'm over 6 foot at this point. Anyway, the rest of his points. Don't wear belts because belts divide your body into segments and they draw the eye downward. You know, hats do the same. They draw your eye upward. So don't wear belts. You know, you want to wear high-waisted pants. Again, you don't want to divide your body and have your eye drawn downward. So if you wear high-waisted pants, you know, up around just tucked under your armpits, it's going to draw people's eyes up. They're going to think, man, that kid has amazingly long legs. You know, look where the waist of his pants is. He's got an incredibly small torso, though. So I think this part's problematic. But, you know, who knows? It might work for you. The last one that he's got that I'm going to focus on is dress in monochromatic color schemes. You know, if you only wear one color, your eye doesn't have to factor in any breaks. Again, we're talking about how the belt breaks things up. Your pants breaks things up. If it's all monochrome, a monochromatic color scheme, there's no breaks. You know, your shoes, your pants, your shirt, all of those things are the same color. Your big hat, all of those are the same color. You're naturally going to appear, you know, appear taller. Along those lines, I wonder what happens if you'd wear, you know, like a jumpsuit or something. It's a one piece, so no breaks at all. It's a one color kind of a thing. There's no belt. Seems like it's checking all the boxes. You know, just get something that looks like prison garb, and you might be good to go. You know, prisoners, you know, I don't have a lot of experience, but they do seem, you know, quite tall when I encounter them or when I see them in movies. They seem big. Might be the jumpsuit doing that. So if I can find a prison suit that, you know, kind of feels business casual, you know, that might help me clock in at some bigger heights, some taller heights. But with all of these things that I'm doing with the hat, the shoes, and all of those things, and the illusions that I'm creating by wearing my prison business casual suit, I've gained, I don't even know how many inches anymore, but I'm clocking in around 6'1", 6'2". If I do the exercise, lose the belly fat, and my spine decompresses, oh my goodness, look out, I'm going to have to be bending to get into doorways. So anyway, there you go. If you're struggling with height and you want to look taller, you want to be a mountain of a man, it's all about how you dress. It's all about the accoutrements that you bring to the process. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to get to the actual paint point, how to make your small room look bigger using nothing but paint. It's similar in concept, but way better because it's smart and I came up with it. All right, it's all next. Stick around. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. You know, people often think of paint as just another line item on the project supply list. But here's the thing. Everything you do, every hour of prep, every stroke of the brush, all comes down to the quality of the paint. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. And we're back. You're listening to a special best of episode of Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Let's get to the paint point. I mean, finally, right? Let's get to the paint point. You know, last segment, I gave out some solid gold advice on how to make yourself look taller using nothing but clothes, shoes, good posture, a little bit of weight loss, but not much. But now let's get to the paint point and let's talk about how to make small rooms in your home feel larger just by using paint. You know, if we all had the budget and the layout of the home allowed us to, it'd be really nice, you know, to knock down walls, expand rooms, and really make our spaces bigger. But that's expensive. And often it's impossible with our home's layout. So let's talk about an easier way to do it. In fact, let's talk about 5 practical ways to make a room feel larger just by using paint. All right, first up, you've got to use the right colors. And typically, we'd recommend lighter colors because they reflect more light. And this, in turn, when it's reflecting light, is going to create a sense of openness. So think off-whites, light neutrals, pales, pastels, pretty much anything that doesn't weigh the room down visually. A great example of this would be to think about some soft blues. You know, I know blue isn't everybody's color, but these shades naturally recede. So the walls seem to push back, to fall back. For dim rooms, you could try an airy blue, kind of like Benjamin Moore's smoke, and actually just put it on the ceiling. And it's kind of like you rip the ceiling off of the home, and there's nothing but blue sky overhead. It's open, it's airy, it's expansive. And if the room doesn't have a lot of natural lighting coming through, you could pair that blue ceiling with an off-white that kind of has a warm, you know, sunny undertone. And if you do that, you've got this, you know, something that feels like an eternal spring day going on in that room. And that kind of tone gives off open, expansive, airy vibes all day long, right? So light, neutral colors, that's the way to go. But there's a little bit of a problem. Now, if you listen to the show on a regular basis, and if you don't, well, I don't know what's wrong with you. But if you listen on a regular basis, you've got to be wondering about some of what I'm saying. You know, after all, we've talked on the show tons of times about how darker colors can make a room feel bigger, too. Right? You've got to be wondering what's up with that. Well, here's the scoop. Darker colors can create depth by making walls visually recede. All of that's true. However, there is a bit of a catch. It works best on one or two walls or the ceiling, not the whole room. Also, and probably more importantly, good lighting is absolutely crucial. You know, otherwise you just risk making the room feel enclosed. So in smaller rooms with limited light, which is what we're talking about, lighter colors are usually going to be your best bet. Dark colors can work wonders too, but only with the right setup. All right, next, try a monochromatic color scheme. Now, it's almost like we ripped this off from the fashion article. But really, what's true in fashion is true with design. Using different shades and tones of the same color for the walls, trim, and ceiling is going to create a continuous look and really help minimize visual breaks. And this is going to expand the space. For example, if your walls are a canvas-colored neutral, you could use a lighter neutral or a deeper off-white on the trim. You know, a stark white on the trim would break the room into more clearly defined segments, and that would make it feel more closed in. If you really want to eliminate the line, you know, really go whole hog into, you know, opening up that space, you could look at the third trick, and that's color drenching. And basically, this means using one single color everywhere, walls, trims, ceilings, maybe even furniture. You know, it's dramatic, it's crazy bold, but it does a better job than monochromatic schemes when it comes to eliminating visual breaks. You know, no more crown molding, no more baseboard, no more doors cutting up your space into smaller chunks. It's all one color. Everything blends, and you've got this unified, larger feel. Now, for those with imagination out there, just imagine a small room with soft green on every single surface. You know, the same color on everything. And when you've got that, the breaks completely disappear. The room flows. The space just feels way bigger. Now, if you can't imagine that, well, the Google is going to help you out. Google color drenching. You'll get an idea. All right, moving on. Idea number four is to consider accent walls. You know, a darker shade on the far end of a narrow room can add depth and make that room feel longer. Last, and kind of similar to accent walls, don't forget about the power of two-toned walls to draw the eye upward. You know, paint the lower half of your walls all the way around the room a lighter shade, and then the upper half, including the ceiling, a little bit darker. Or you could try the reverse. You know, either way, this is going to blend the ceiling with the walls, and it erases that dividing line and naturally draws your eye upward and gives the illusion or impression of height and space. We talked about that a couple of times in the last month or so, and if you missed those shows, just head back to the archives and check them out. All right, there you go. That's the paint point for the week. Five techniques to make small spaces feel bigger. You know, remember that paint, it's not just about color. It's about creating atmosphere, about tone, you know, creating the tone that you want. It's even about creating space. For a relatively small investment, you can transform pretty much any room in your house, no matter what architectural constraints you're working with. If you do have questions or tips of your own, any painting tips, any painting questions, maybe a topic you'd like me to tackle on the show, or even a friend or a relative, or maybe a contractor that you think should be interviewed, if you've got any of those ideas, I'd love to hear from you. So email me at radio@repcolite.com and let me know what you're thinking. All right, let's take a break right now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the history of glass on this special best of episode of Home in Progress. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Think about it. You spend hours prepping, sanding, taping, and then finally painting. Don't throw all that work away with an inferior product. The paint isn't just another supply. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. And we're back. You're listening to a special best of episode of Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And I hope that after last segment, I hope a lot of you are thinking about a couple of projects that you can tackle today or this weekend or even next week. You know, who cares? Just get some of these things crossed off your list. It feels great when you do that. And I do want to say before I move on to the topic I want to talk about next, If any of the projects that you're thinking about tackling, if they do involve paint issues that you're not sure how to handle or work around, by all means, let us help. You know, we're here to make your next job easier than you think it's going to be, and we'll help you find your colors, we'll help you choose the best products for whatever you've got cooking, and we'll also help you troubleshoot any issues that you're dealing with. You know, with my plaster problems, the first thing I did was run the situation past some of the people at Repcolite. You know, I had my own ideas about what was going on, but there are people here with way more experience. They've been here longer yet, and they helped me figure out the source of the problem. So whatever you've got going on, if it's paint related, we're here to help, and we can help. So reach out. All right, let's make an abrupt shift and talk about glass. Now, when I think about all of the amazing inventions that have happened throughout history, I can tell you glass isn't going to be on that list. You know, not initially anyway. I'd think of the wheel, you know, the steam engine, the computer, the printing press, you know, quite honestly, the indoor flushing toilet, right? I mean, that would be way up on my charts. Think about what life would be like without the indoor flushing toilet. It was a cold week last week. Can you imagine? We'd be spending so much time outside, so much frostbite, in so many strange places. So, indoor flushing toilet, that's big. I'd think about all of those things before I'd think about glass. And yet, when you look at it, glass has profoundly shaped civilization, and it doesn't really take much thinking to see all of its contributions. You know, right off the bat, its transparency revolutionized architecture. You know, now we can allow natural light into buildings while still providing insulation and protection. So it's huge in that regard. In science, glass enabled the creation of microscopes and telescopes. You know, all of a sudden we can look out to the universe way out there, thanks to glass, and we can also look at the universe, you know, microscopically. You know, look at the tiny little world that's happening. You know, not just at my house, because it's a tiny little world at my house, too, but the microscopically tiny little world that happens all around us. Thanks to glass, we can explore those things. Artists and craftsmen, they've used glass for centuries, you know, from intricate stained glass windows in cathedrals to delicate Venetian glasswork that symbolizes, you know, luxury and refinement, the things that you would find at the Hansen House. You know, luxury, refinement, sheer culture, all thanks to glass. Now, glass has also become essential in communication and entertainment. You know, it forms the screens of our televisions, our smartphones, our computers. In daily life, it simplifies everything from preserving food in jars to keeping us comfortable with energy-efficient windows. Really, you know, bottom line, it's one of the most impactful materials in human history. You know, blending function with art, it's like the perfect thing. So glass is a major contender, and it should be a major contender when we're considering, you know, top inventions of all time. But is glass really an invention? There's probably people out there right now saying, is glass an invention or was it a discovery? Maybe it was an innovation. Well, it turns out, really, it's all three of those things. It's a discovery because glass exists in nature. You're right. When certain conditions cause silica-rich materials to melt and cool rapidly, we get naturally occurring glass, you know, to some extent. A well-known example is obsidian, which is naturally occurring volcanic glass formed when lava cools rapidly without crystallizing. So it is a discovery. It's also an invention because there was a point in time when humans figured out how to reproduce and control the formation of glass for tools, decorative items, and so on. So it's an invention too, and it's also an innovation because, of course, over thousands of years, glassmaking has been continuously improved, like everything else, to create everything from super clear window panes to fiber optics and on and on and on. So it's all three: discovery, invention, and innovation. And it all started, according to legend, around 3500 BC, when some Phoenician merchants, they're cooking on a sandy beach, you know, they've been traveling around selling their stuff. Probably selling paint to people all over the place. And they got to stop. They got to rest. They pull up to some beach somewhere, and they start cooking dinner. And they're using these blocks of natron, which is basically a type of soda ash, using those blocks to prop up their pots. So they're sitting there. They're cooking. The fire ends up getting hot enough that the sand and the ash melt together. And boom, there you go. Glass. They've got some kind of glassy substance that they find. That's one legend. Another supposition is that around the same time, 3500 BC, glass was discovered as an accidental byproduct of pottery kilns. Early artisans discovered that mixing sand, soda ash, and lime, and then heating it up really, really heating it up, doing that resulted in a translucent material. Now, however, glass was first discovered. We don't know if either one of those are even remotely accurate, but they're the guesses. However, glass was first discovered. Throughout the subsequent years, people did figure out how to create it so that by 2000 BC, like 1500 years later yet, the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians were crafting glass beads. By 1500 BC, the first glass containers were made in Egypt and the Middle East using a method where glass was wrapped around a clay core, and then the core was scraped away once that glass hardened. Then later, like 1400 years or so later yet, in the first century BC, the big breakthrough came when the Romans adopted the Syrian art of glass blowing and turned it into a major industry. You know, previously, they had kind of left glass alone, the Romans had. But when this comes about, they latch onto it and they go crazy with it. Glass blowing allowed the glass to be shaped really, really quickly and in a wide variety of sizes and styles. And the Romans, like I said, latched onto that. And they were soon crafting everything from, you know, delicate perfume bottles to heavy storage jars, all the way up to tableware, you know, all kinds of tableware. So lots and lots of stuff happens. And there's this huge explosion of glassware around the first century BC. And then later, about the first century AD, we start to see evidence of the Romans using glass for windows. Now, initially, these glass panes were produced by casting molten glass onto wooden frames and then placing those frames on sand or stone surfaces to cool. And then they'd end up with, you know, panes of glass from that. Now, these Roman windows that they made this way, they were cloudy, they were thick, they were full of imperfections. They look like my windows before I did my spring cleaning. Although my windows, you know, it could be cleaned off. These issues were in the glass. Mine were just on the glass, you know, squished mosquitoes and things like that. But anyway, they weren't the best. They weren't the most crystal clear windows that we would think of, but they were still revolutionary. You know, for the first time, some structures could have actual windows, glass windows, instead of wooden shutters or cloth coverings. Now, sure, it was only the wealthy people. Wealthy people got all these things to begin with, but for the first time, bugs, wind, rain, all of that could be kept out while still being able to see out. You know, they could let light in, but not let the elements or all of God's little creatures come crawling in. So that's going on first century AD. By the late third century, the broadsheet or muff process was introduced for producing windows. And all this means is glass was blown into a, you know, a big cylinder, and that cylinder was cut and then flattened into a sheet. That's the broadsheet or muff process. There were other methods that developed later, the crown method for creating windows. I'm not going to go all into all of that. There's just not enough time. But later in the Middle Ages, things got fancier yet. And that's when we saw the introduction of intricate stained glass windows in Gothic cathedrals. Stained glass existed before this, but it got crazy intricate in these cathedrals in the Middle Ages. Now, fast forward to the 17th and 18th centuries, and suddenly glass is starting to become a lot more common. And the reason is the Industrial Revolution. New production processes allowed for, you know, bigger, clearer, more affordable glass panes. And then by the 19th century, we've got glass windows everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's glass windows. And that's when we start to get a whole big crop of kids who realize the fun of throwing rocks through those glass windows. It all started right around that same time. The windows at this point were single pane, so that meant they were drafty and not terribly great at insulation. A lot better than an open hole in the house, but still not great. That problem was solved in the 20th century with the birth of double pane windows. 1930s. In 1934, I think, is when the patent was filed or approved, and that's when the first double pane windows were developed. And this was a big deal because the double pane windows trapped heat in the winter and it kept it out in the summer. Homeowners suddenly had, you know, quite a bit more comfortable home, and it also had a tendency to lower energy bills. By the 70s, gases were being introduced between those double-paned windows to help with efficiency. And then by the 1980s, low-E coatings came along. And these coatings, if you've never heard of them, you've probably heard of them, but these coatings reflected heat, that's the whole point, while still letting light through. All of that came about in the 80s or so. By the late 80s into the 90s, we're starting to see triple-pane glass. You know, that's becoming a growing option. It's more energy efficient and soundproof than double pane windows, but it's also, of course, you know, ka-ching, pricier. And that's kind of where we're at. I mean, there's advancements. There's always advancements. But that gives you a really good thumbnail sketch of the history of glass, how we got from, you know, beads in the sand somewhere, you know, glass beads in the sand, all the way up to windows in our homes. So now let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to kind of settle in on windows and talk about some common issues that occur and how you can deal with them. That's all just ahead. Stick around. You're listening to Home in Progress, where the projects are real, the mistakes, they're educational, sometimes painful, mostly educational, and the only thing more stubborn than that old wallpaper on your bathroom wall is your determination to get it fixed. Proudly sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Paint with a purpose, people who care, and everything you need to get the job done right. And we're back. You're listening to a special best of episode of Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And last segment, we talked about the history of glass and how we got to windows in the first place. And now in this last segment, I want to talk about some common issues that can occur with windows and how you can address them. And I should be extremely clear here. You probably already know this. I'm skimming over these. I mean, it's radio. I'm doing what I can. But if you do need more info or need to pursue a fix, of course, you know, contact a window specialist and get them out to your home or do a little Googling. Some of these things are things that you can fix, you know, easily on your own. All right, some common problems. Drafty windows and air leaks. Here are some things that you can do to try to fix it. You first need to determine where this is all coming from. Where's the source of the problem? If it's coming in around the trim of your window, which is entirely possible, you can go around and caulk all the edges to seal the gaps there. There are a variety of different caulks that we carry at Repco Light that would work for this, and in a decent range of colors, to be honest, everything from whites and clears to grays and browns. So really, you should be able to find something that will blend away against whatever your window trim looks like. And if you are going to be repainting that window trim, you know, you want to caulk it and then repaint everything. If you're going to do that, make sure, absolute sure, that you're getting a paintable caulk. You know, that's the first thing. Get a paintable caulk and go from there. And if that is what you're going to be doing, caulking and then painting, and you're looking for a caulk recommendation, I'd recommend Accelerator Caulk from Tower Sealants, or if you're in the Metro Detroit area shopping at any of the Repco Light stores out there, ask for Quick to Coat Caulk. Accelerator and Quick to Coat, basically they're the same product. They're just packaged differently depending on where you get it. Either way, that caulk can be applied and then painted over with a brush or roller in just 30 minutes. And that's pretty much unheard of. So you can paint over it right away. If you're spraying over it, you can spray over it immediately after application. So if you're a painting contractor, Accelerator Caulk, Quick to Coat, those can be sprayed over immediately. So think about that. Keep that in mind. Most of the problems that we see with caulking are due to people painting over it too quickly. Accelerator or Quick to Coat pretty much removes that concern. So if you're caulking around your window trim to seal those gaps and you're going to be painting over all of that, Accelerator or Quick to Coat, that's the perfect caulk solution. So that's one fix. Another fix is maybe to install one of those window insulation kits. You know, it's not permanent. It's probably not the most convenient thing in the whole wide world. No problems about it. It's not the most convenient thing in the whole wide world, but it will get you some relief. So think about that. Long-term solutions, pretty much, you know, you can consider upgrading to double or triple pane windows, you know, with advanced sealing technology, stuff like that. Really look into those things. As you're looking into new windows, let the people know that's one of your main issues that you need to fix. And make sure you're selecting windows and installers and all of that who are going to make sure that you achieve those goals. All right, so that's drafty windows or windows with a lot of air leaks. Condensation on the windows. Now, sometimes we get water forming on the windows, you know, inside the home. And I'm talking about on the glass, not between the panes. That's different. Sometimes it's just a little bit of water that we get on the glass, but sometimes it can be significant. And if there's a fair amount of water condensing there, it can lead to the growth of mold and mildew on your trim, on your blinds, on the window itself. Reality, this really isn't a window problem per se. The condensation appears when warm, moist air comes into contact with a cooler surface. And even though we're in winter and the air in the home seems pretty dry, condensation can still occur on windows as long as there's a significant temperature difference between the warm indoor air and the cold window surface. Now, the moisture that we've got in our indoor air comes from pretty much everyday living, you know, cooking, showering, doing the dishes, pretty much any activity that we do that uses water adds to it. You know, right now, a lot of us this time of year are running a humidifier in the home to help with the dry air. But even doing that, you know, running that humidifier, obviously, is adding to the condensation problem on the windows if you're experiencing one. So some things to try. If you've got that problem going on and you want to limit it or minimize it, lower, first off, the settings on your humidifier if you're running one. See if you can lower it down to the point where you find the balance, you know, the butter zone, the Goldilocks number between humidifying the air enough but not too much. You know, see if you can do that. Another thing you can do is run your exhaust fan when you're boiling water while cooking. You can run the bathroom exhaust fans during and after showering. The rule of thumb when you're running your bathroom fan, just to throw this out there, is that you run that bathroom fan until the mirror is clear. And I'm talking about you're doing this if you've got a condensation problem on your windows. If you don't, well, then you're just sucking the home completely dry and you're going to static cling yourself into kingdom come. So this is for the people with the window problems, with the condensation on the windows. Another trick that you can try, or a solution, it's not a trick, you use the trickle vents on your windows if you've got them. And trickle vents, if you're unsure of what these are, they're essentially slits in the frame. They're staggered on the inside and the outside, and they've got a cover that can be opened and closed. If you've got newer windows and you see these little trickle vents, make sure they're opened. That can help a lot by providing continual ventilation. All right, that's condensation on the glass. What if you've got condensation between the two panes of glass? Now, if that's where it's happening, the cause for that is that there's a broken seal in the window. And fixing this is usually going to need an expert. Depending on the condition and the age of the windows, it's possible that just the glass unit can be replaced, and that can save you some money. Other times, you know, if it's just not worth doing that, you're probably looking at replacing the entire window to get things back up to speed so you can see through it and enjoy the clarity of the view rather than look at all that condensation in there. All right. What about windows that won't open or close properly? This really stinks, right? You got a window, you can open it. All you want to do is just enjoy the fresh air or whatever, and it keeps lowering itself closed, or it doesn't slide up easily or whatever. Well, if you've got that going on, there are a complete huge list of reasons why it could be doing this. You'll have to do a little research here. It could be swollen wooden frames, you know, moisture problems or something like that that has swelled the wooden frames. It could be warped components. It could be any number of things. You know, in my double hung replacement windows at home, there's a component in the track that's called a pivot shoe. Pretty much most of the windows that we all encounter are going to have these. Not all, but most replacement windows will. There's a pivot shoe, it's called. It's something that we don't usually see when everything's working fine. But I've had a number of times when the window won't stay open. It just kind of slides its way down. And then when I try to close it, it won't go all the way down because there's this small mechanism thing in the track that seems to be blocking it. Well, if you see that or have that going on, that's the pivot shoe right there. It's not in the right place. And what happens is sometimes that window sash can come loose from that pivot shoe if the window is tilted incorrectly or if it's forced out of alignment. Either way, the good news is that if this has happened to you, it's a relatively simple fix. I don't have time to walk through it here because there are some specifics that it's too much to explain in the time I've got. But I've got a great video linked in the show notes. So if this sounds like your issue and you want to know the simple fix to getting everything working just fine again on your own, a do-it-yourself solution, probably take you 20 minutes, if that, just head to repcolite.com and check out the show notes for episode 398. I'll have a link for the video right there. You can watch it, and he'll walk you through everything you need to know. Now, for window issues beyond this pivot shoe problem, you really need to determine whether repairs are possible or if a full replacement is necessary to maintain functionality and safety. Now, if your window sticks, you know, all the things we talked about, it doesn't stay open, won't open smoothly, but you can't see anything obvious, you know, there's no obvious damage or obstruction, it's possible the issue could be due to the house settling. You know, over time, a shifting foundation will cause windows, you know, window frames to become misaligned, and that can make operation difficult. Now, if you do suspect that, I've got that going on in a window in my home, it may be worth consulting Ayers Basement Systems or a similar foundation specialist to assess whether the settling is normal. You know, it's just kind of it happened, it's a done deal, this is what you've got, move on. Or if there's a bigger problem, the house is sinking, you know, into some kind of sinkhole. It's not fun to find that out, but it's better to find it out now than it is to find it out later. Anyway, those are some common window issues and some of the solutions. Dig into it further if you've got any of those issues. All right, that's all the time we've got. We're going to wrap this one up. If you want to catch it again, you can find it online at repcolite.com. Whatever you do today, make sure paint's a part of it. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I'll see you next week. I'm Dan Hansen. Thanks for listening.